Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. We have a lot to share today. I'm going to take you on a journey of what is called a meta-analysis, meaning many studies, that reveal that you have a lower risk of dying of everything if you have a particular nutrient. In fact, this was done over a 29-year period. Also, they finally isolated what's in chocolate that could help prevent diabetes. That's a good thing. And why about 2 ounces a day is good for you. Also today, we'll be looking at chowing down on watermelon. What's in watermelon that makes it so good for a particular condition? This is a major study from a peer-reviewed journal. I love watermelon. I have watermelon every single day if it's in season. Also, precancerous breast cells treated with a vitamin created non-cancerous cells. Brand new information. Also, another good study on what chocolate does to turn off inflammation in your joints. Well, that's good for arthritis. And an in-depth classroom on the air today, extra virgin olive oil. A lot of it's a fraud. So I'm going to show you how to purchase olive oil to make sure you're getting the real stuff and not the fake stuff that is mainly controlled by the Italian mob, and how they do it and how you can not be fooled. John Thomas, Health Impact News. Then, lots of commentaries today, shorter ones, but all relevant to those who listen to this program. We know that there has been discrimination against blacks. That's no secret. But I want to give you the latest on how we are confirming the dehumanization of black children and the preschool to prison pipeline. We're going to look at that. Then, Fort Hood, post-traumatic stress and the true cost of U.S. wars of choice. And I'm going to be doing a one-hour special about what really caused the Fort Hood shooting and almost all other shootings in all schools in the last 30 years, the psychiatric medications. But we have the actual documentation. We have the exact drugs that the shooters were on, what milligrams they were using, what combinations they were using, and then we'll show you the side effects that the manufacturer even acknowledges, rage and homicidal tendencies and suicide. So that will be something different than what you're currently hearing. Also, the Koch brothers are introducing Monsanto-backed bills that would bar every state in America from labeling laws that would let you know if a food has been genetically engineered. So we'll tell you about that and all the more reason that we support an anti-GMO purpose at all radio stations. Obama definitely lied about having intent to prosecute the bad guys on Wall Street, according to Eric Zuss, Global Research, and how predatory college loans are bankrupting the financial future of America's youth and what we should do about it. And if time permits, the prison industry in the United States, it's big business, but it's also a form of new slavery. From Global Research, Vicky Pellis. As you see, we have a lot to cover. If time permits, I'll have open calls at the end for talkback. Let's begin. One way that we know that something is relevant in science is, can it be replicated over a period of time by other individuals and come up with the same results? Let me give an example. I have a new study that is being considered for peer review publication as we speak, and I have been given an invitation to present my findings before a large number of scientists later this year. And what will happen is this. I'll present my findings, which are rather really extreme in a good way, the results, and no one's been able to come up with these before anywhere in medicine or science. Now, because all the attendees will be either medical doctors or PhDs and scientists, and they're all interested in this particular topic, It's a specific scientific conference. Now, then they'll go home. They'll all have a copy of the protocol and the results done by independent analysis. Then they will be able to use this on their patients or in some clinical setting. If a year from now they've been able to come up with similar results that I have using the same protocol, then this will be able to go forward within a mainstream healing. It'll have that acknowledgement that it passed the tough standards, the gold standards. But that's what good science should be. For example, when we don't get enough vitamin D, there are at least 100 studies showing that most Americans are deficient in vitamin D. It's not just about your bones. It's about your immune system. It's about inflammation in the body. It's about so many biological processes. So when 100 different studies show that, hey, you don't have enough vitamin D, you're going to be in trouble, then it's something that all of medicine and all of public health and all dietitians and nurses should pay attention to. Get Americans to get more vitamin D, especially in the wintertime, when we're almost always universally deficient. This is the latest published in the British Medical Journal. It is a meta-analysis that reveals that you actually lower your risk of dying if you have vitamin D3 in your body over a 29-year period. Quote, British Medical Journal concluded an association between a higher serum level of vitamin D and a lower risk of death from any cause, heart disease, cancer, doesn't matter, any cause, you're less likely to die up to 29 years later. That is impressive. That is outstanding science. So there were 73 separate observational cohort studies that looked at vitamin D3 and the cause of death in 849,412 men and women who were followed. The analysis uncovered, quote, a 35% higher risk of death from cardiovascular disease or any other cause if they were deficient in vitamin D3. But it reversed itself if you had abundant vitamin D3. You were less likely to die. So that's the takeaway message. Now you realize you could be living much longer, even with existing diseases, if you have your vitamin D3. How much? I'm going to suggest about 2,000 to 3,000 units a day. Or if you're in a sunny environment, as many people listening are, then 1 hour of direct sunlight without sunscreen. Now, that doesn't mean go out and get yourself a sunburn. It means that get yourself some morning sun and some late afternoon sun, and because sunscreen blocks vitamin D. Everyone likes chocolate, but there's two types of chocolate. There's actually three. There is the general confection chocolate, uses confection sugar and dairy products and chemicals. That's an unhealthy type. There is a healthier chocolate that doesn't use the dairy and doesn't use the processed sugars. And then there's the raw chocolate, which is the healthiest of them all. Here's the latest in the American Chemical Society, which is the largest group of scientists in the world. And this was in their Journal of the Agriculture and Food Chemistry. Quote, improved thinking, decreased appetite, lower blood pressure. This is all from consuming dark chocolate and now diabetes, the prevention of diabetes and even obesity. They have found a particular type of antioxidant in cocoa that is involved in all this. And keep in mind, there are hundreds of different flavanols in foods. You might have 200 or 300 different chemicals in a carrot. So we're talking about tens of thousands of chemicals that nature's provided us with. We've probably only identified 10% at most. But in the chocolate, they've identified the flavanol, which is a type of antioxidant, and it works differently than other compounds, and it's able to impact the body in a way that benefits all these different diseases, stopping them. So 2 ounces of chocolate a day, dark chocolate, in the healthy chocolate. When I do the New York City Marathon, I frequently take watermelon. I'll juice it, and then I'll add some coconut water to it, and that gives me the potassium and electrolytes and energy necessary to sustain the marathon. In fact, just about a month ago, I did the National 20K Championship, and at the tables where the athletes zip by, they grab their beverages. Most had some kind of cola or caffeine. I didn't. I had the watermelon juice with coconut water. Had no problem with energy at all. And this was in a hot environment. And that's what I've advocated athletes to use. This is from Florida State University. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal American Journal of Hypertension. This is from a professor, Figueroa, who said that watermelon could lower blood pressure. Quote, the pressure on the aorta and on the heart decrease after consuming watermelon. Wow. More people die of heart attacks in cold weather because the stress of the cold temperature causes blood pressure to increase, and your heart has to work harder to pump blood into the aorta. That often leads to less blood flow to the heart. Hence, people who are overweight or who have high blood pressure, frequently one and the same, are at a higher risk for stroke or heart attack when exposed to the cold, either during the winter or in rooms with low temperatures. So, turns out that watermelon is the answer. There was a 12-week study focused on middle-aged, obese men and women who also suffer from high blood pressure. To simulate cold weather conditions, they had the temperature brought down, and then they also took their blood pressure. This went on for weeks, and then they switched it and used a placebo, and what they found was that, quote, that means less overload to the heart, so the heart is going to work easily during a stressful situation such as cold exposure. So, eat your watermelon, drink your watermelon juice, and help prevent a heart attack or a stroke, especially if you have high blood pressure. That's good news. Precancerous breast cancer cells treated with vitamin A reverted into non-cancerous cells. From Thomas Jefferson University, published in the peer-reviewed journal, International Journal of Oncology, a derivative of vitamin A, known as retinoic acid, which is found abundantly in sweet potatoes and carrots, helps turn precancerous cells back into normal, healthy breast cells. The research could help explain why some clinical studies have been unable to see a benefit of vitamin A on cancer. The vitamin doesn't appear to change the course of full-blown cancer, but it does with precancerous cells, and we all have precancer before we have cancer. The key is, if we started using this on a regular basis, it could help prevent precancer from becoming cancer. So, this is good news also. One more reason to have your sweet potatoes, yams, and carrots and squash on a regular basis. One more good piece of research from Louisiana State University researchers and at a national meeting of the American Chemical Society in Dallas, they found that the polyphenolic antioxidant compounds plus the fiber in chocolate was able to turn off inflammation in your gut. So let's just look at the area we're talking about, the stomach, the large intestine, the small intestine, itis, ileitis, gastroenteritis, Crohn's disease, spastic colon, irritable bowel syndrome. Hey, the coca is good for it. And finally, most people in this audience, I'm sure, have used extra virgin olive oil. And the key is just like honey. I've been giving you some reports. You've got to get the honey that is dark, that is not the commercial honey that is certified organic, because otherwise you could just be getting some minimal honey with some form of glucose solution that is made in China and then shipped to another country. It is bottled in another country and then shipped in the United States. And it's not going to do you any good at all. In fact, it could do you harm. The same is true about olive oil. I want to share some insights that were uncovered in a good investigative report by John P. Thomas of Health Impact News, because we all would like to trust the label. But how would you know that your extra virgin olive oil is real? Why? Because numerous scandals have been uncovered over the last 20 years, which have revealed that many extra virgin olive oils being sold in the United States do not meet the high standard of this product. Many have been adulterated with lower grade olive oils or with nut and seed oils. Others simply have serious flavor and aroma defects, which would prevent them from being called extra virgin. Just 2 weeks ago, the beginning stage of a class action lawsuit was undertaken to bring charges against a company for selling a product labeled as pure olive oil when the olive, or the oil, was extracted from olive pomace by means of chemical solvents in extreme high temperatures. And olive pomace is the solid residue that is left over from the traditional production of olive oil. Now, the class action will allege fraud, negligent misrepresentation, and breach of warranty under New York and New Jersey laws. And in an article that appeared in The New Yorker, Tom Mueller provided an update to the olive oil adulteration problem, which he first described in his book, Extra Virginity, The Sublime and Scandalous World of Olive Oil. And his book was the first to expose the contamination of extra virgin olive oil with other types of plant oils and the misuse of the label extra virgin. Quote, there's a strong downward pressure on olive oil quality, especially among the huge Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian-owned olive oil traders and bottling companies. There is a massive output of low-grade olive oils, particularly in Spain and North Africa, but throughout the European Union, which producers are selling as extra virgin olive oil, even though this low-grade oil doesn't meet the requirements of the extra virgin grade. So while the best extra virgin olive oils in history are now being made, more and more low-grade oils are also being included in the category. And then a study at the Olive Center at the University of California, Davis, I didn't even know there was such a place as the Olive Center, tested a selection of extra virgin olive oils purchased from California grocery stores. They were testing to determine whether products marked as extra virgin olive oil actually met the international extra virgin standard. Now, quote, the research team found that 69% of the imported oil sampled, compared with 10% of the California-produced oil sampled, failed to meet international accepted standards. And the report from a second study conducted at UC Davis Olive Center revealed further distressing news about olive oil that was sold to restaurants and food service operations. 21 olive oil brands were examined. 15 were marked as extra virgin. In order for an olive oil to be labeled extra virgin, it must pass a chemical analysis and a sensory analysis. They found that all but one of the oils marked as extra virgin were not. Despite this, 60% of the samples failed USDA sensory standards for extra virgin, meaning the flavor, aroma, appearance, and physical characteristics. The most common sensory defects were flavors and aromas described as rancid, fusty, or muddy and musty. And these 9 oils also failed to pass a chemical test for the compound that dichloroglycerol, a standard adopted by the Australian Olive Association, and it was impure. So then how do you purchase authentic extra virgin olive oil? Well, don't be dismayed by the corruption. The good news is you can still buy high-quality extra virgin olive oil. And before you decide to never buy extra virgin olive oil again, please keep in mind that even though some brands failed the test, there are many exceptionally fine brands of extra virgin olive oil in the United States and in Europe. And in order to become a savvy consumer and to bring home what you intended to purchase, it'll help you to learn a few bits about the terminology of the olive oil trade. You'll find olive oil labels that tell you that the oil is in the bottle is extra virgin olive oil, virgin olive oil, pure olive oil, and olive pomace. The last type, olive pomace, technically should not be called olive oil because it's extracted with chemical solvents from the industrial waste that is produced by standard olive oil manufacturing. They'll be more informed about olive pomace later. Extra virgin is the highest quality and the most expensive olive oil. It should have no defects, should have a high organoleptic profile. In other words, it should not have defects such as being musty, being fusty, meaning fermented smell, similar to bad socks, or having a winey flavor. On the positive side, it should have a collection of qualities that stimulate and satisfy the sense of smell and vision and physical sensation of the mouth. Now, this is how the Olive Oil Times defines extra virgin olive oil. Quote, in chemical terms, extra virgin olive oil is described as having a free acidity expressed as oleic acid, and it must also pass official chemical test. So you want it to be fruity, slightly acrid, but not bitter, and certainly not pungent. It's just slightly more acidic. But otherwise, if you've had it, you know it, and it's delicious. So when you go into your health food store, and I hope that's where you're buying it, buy the organic because there's a higher standard, and they generally don't try to mess with the organic label because it is going to be tested, and if it doesn't meet the test, it's not sold. So I would say look for the organic extra virgin on the label, and also cold pressed. Most all olive oils are processed by means of centrifuge. If it's a true extra virgin olive oil, then it was pressed at a cool temperature. Look at the dates in the bottle. There should be a best use by date, and the standard is 24 months in the date of packaging. And look for olive oil that is in a dark glass bottle. Light accelerates the deterioration of olive oil. Also, when you're in Italy, you'll see that in homes, they almost always have large containers in dark for their olive oil. And you don't see them in light. You don't see them near any light. And so that's how I go about buying my extra virgin olive oil. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, just something on our environmental segment here today. We have two issues. One is the Koch brothers have an ally. Representative Mike Pompeo, he is introducing legislation backed by powerful trade groups to prevent states from passing laws requiring labeling of genetically modified foods. The bill is linked to biotech giant Monsanto and Koch Industries. Pompeo will offer the bill in the U.S. House of Representatives later this month. The Hill newspaper reported, citing industry sources. Politico also reported on the impending proposal, and Pompeo's office would not comment on the congressman's intentions. So I think we should let our legislators know, as of today, no to this labeling bill. No to Pompeo, P-O-M-P-E-O, Pompeo. All right? It's the name is Coalition. It was revealed in recent months that powerful farming and biotechnology interest groups like Monsanto were joining forces. Their name is Coalition for Safe, Affordable Food. That's just all a front. This is Monsanto. So a top member of the coalition, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, a major food industry lobbying group, raised and spent $22 million on killing in Washington State and in California are labeling. So we need to act together, and we need to let our legislators know no. Now, it may be hard for most people to appreciate why we should be concerned because they have the house fixed. Let's just take a look at some of the people from Monsanto. Tom Moffat, Dennis DeConcey, lawyer from Monsanto, Margaret Miller, chemical lab supervisor, Monsanto, Marcia Hale, Director of International Government Affairs, Monsanto, Mickey Cantor, board member, Monsanto, Virginia Weldon, Vice President, Public Policy, Monsanto, Josh King, Director of International Government Affairs, Monsanto, David Beller, Vice President, Government and Public Affairs, Monsanto, Carol Tucker Foreman, Monsanto lobbyist, Linda Fisher, Vice President, Government and Public Affairs, Monsanto, Linda Wattrud, Manager, New Technologies, Monsanto, Michael Taylor, Vice President, Public Policy and Lawyer, Monsanto, Hillary Clinton, let me repeat that, Hillary Clinton, Rose Law Firm, she was the counsel for Monsanto, Roger Bishi, Director, Monsanto Danforth Center, Islam Siddiqui, Monsanto lobbyist. Why is this important? Because look where they went. And one became a Democrat congressman, another one became a Democrat senator, another one became a Bush and Clinton director of the FDA, another came a Clinton White House staff director, Secretary of Commerce under Clinton. Al Gore's top man was from Monsanto. White House communications director was Monsanto. Gore's chief domestic policy advisor was from Monsanto. That guy is Dan Beller. Appointed counsel was Carol Tucker Foreman. Deputy administrator of the EPA, Monsanto. USDA director, Monsanto. EPA director, Monsanto. Deputy commissioner of the FDA, Monsanto. U.S. Senator, Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, Monsanto. Director of the USDA and NIFA, Monsanto. Agriculture negotiator, trade representative for all these deals, Monsanto. So for those who are naive enough to believe that they shouldn't pay attention to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to Monsanto, to state labeling laws, understand that they're those in positions of power in both the Clinton and Bush and Obama administration who are all on Monsanto's payroll. And that's where their loyalty lay. And finally, from our environmental group, I've been mentioning that the two biggest efforts that we're going to see in the upcoming 5 years is a scramble for who owns the water and who owns the land. Because the reality is whoever owns food and owns water has enormous control over the quality of our lives. Right now, if you read the headlines, you wouldn't know the true nature of what's going on. But there is a massive movement to give so-called aid to Africa that's going to have no aid for Africa. This is a front. This is a fraud. And it's been given $1 billion, and the so-called executives who are being brought in are from Monsanto, Unilever, and other corporations in order to help the people of Africa. They're doing nothing of a kind. What they're doing, in effect, is that they're uniting together with Bill Clinton and other policy wonks in order to have a corporate power grab, and this will be disastrous for the small-scale farmers who feed at least 70% of Africa's people. Quite simply, it's called the New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition. But again, this is one of those touchy-feely, nicey, you know, new-agey kind of terms, but behind it is the G8 governments, their biggest global food and agricultural companies, who are interested in making more money. How's it work? A new report from the World Development Movement suggests that the New Alliance, which is receiving about $1 billion, will actually increase poverty and inequality in Africa. It's not about growing more food. Remember, we don't have to grow more food. We grow enough food right now in the world to feed 12 billion people a year. No, that's the rhetoric. Oh, we want to save the people. What they want to do is they want to go into sub-Saharan Africa, which produces 10% more food per person than they did 30 years ago. And they want to get the best land. And they've made deals, the New Alliance, with countries such as Ethiopia, Ghana, Tanzania, Barranca, Mozambique, Nigeria, Benin, Malawi, and Senegal. It's the great African land grab. In return, each of the African countries has to agree to make major changes in their laws, all intended to make life easier for being exploited by the big business guys. The reforms require an African country to make it much easier for companies to hold large tracts of farmland. In Ethiopia, for example, a scheme is being set up to fast-track investors' access to land. And like the Ethiopian colonists of the 19th century, proponents of the expansion of agribusiness see Africa's land as underused and ripe for exploitation. But as much of the land being targeted is already home to hundreds of thousands of people who grow and crops and tend animals there, and who depend upon it for water and firewood and medicinal plants or in hunting. At least 56 million acres of land have already been sold or leased in Africa under this deal. That's 56 million. And of course, the natives are kicked off by corporations. They promise jobs, there won't be jobs. They're restricting and privatizing seeds. The new alliance is also privatizing all their seeds, in some countries demanding reforms that restrict small farmers to save their seeds. So if you're an African and you've been living off the land for millennia, and you will now be forced to destroy your seeds to buy their seeds that you have to buy every year. So the giant seed companies, Monsanto, Syngenta, DuPont, they're the big players. They control Clinton. All you have to do is throw money in the air, and suddenly the Clintons come running, and the Democrats right behind them. So this is just such a complete destruction. And yet, there are artificial fertilizers, there's destruction of the water. All this is being done with the idea that they're going to help make it easier for people to eat. No, they're not. They're liars. They're pathological liars. They couldn't tell the truth if they had to. Just one more example of how the public doesn't ask, there's no deeper questions, and there's always a negative consequence. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Well, you're going to be hearing a lot of that kind of music this coming Wednesday evening at our dance party to celebrate all of the people who supported this station in its last fund drive. It's a free dance. We have no more space. We're completely booked out. So we look forward to having an enjoyable evening. For those of you who are coming, and I understand people are coming from Washington, D.C., from my PFW audience down there, let me know when you get there where you're from. Because afterwards, I'm going to take a lot of people out for dessert at 11 o'clock. So as a treat on me for making the effort to come from any place out of the immediate area. And we're going to have a wonderful time. In the remainder of our program, I want to share some commentaries on issues that are not given the attention they deserve in the mainstream or alternative media. The first comes from Sonali Kolhatkar from Truth Dig. It's about studies confirm the dehumanization of black children and the preschool-to-prison pipeline. Now, although African Americans constitute only about 13% of all Americans, nearly half of all prison inmates in the United States are black. Now, this startling statistic has led the United Nations Human Rights Committee to publicly criticize the United States for its treatment of African Americans. A number of recent studies and reports paint a damning picture of how American society dehumanizes blacks starting from early childhood. Racial justice activists and prison abolition groups have long argued that the school-to-prison pipeline funnels young black kids into the criminal justice system, with higher rates of school suspensions and arrests compared with non-black kids for the same infractions. More than 20 years ago, Smith College professor Ann Arnett Ferguson wrote a groundbreaking book based on her three-year study of how black boys, in particular, are perceived differently and in school. Ferguson laid out the ways in which educators and administrators funnel black male students into the juvenile justice system based on perceived differences between them and other students. Today, this trend continues with record numbers of suspensions as a result of zero-tolerance school policies and the increasing presence of campus police officers who arrest students for insubordination or other types of behavior that might be considered normal acting out in school-age children. In fact, black youth are far more likely to be suspended from school than any other race. They also face disproportionate expulsion and arrest rates. And once children enter the juvenile justice system, they are far more likely to be incarcerated as adults. Even the Justice Department under President Obama has understood what a serious problem this is, issuing a set of new guidelines earlier this year to curb discriminatory suspension in schools. But it turns out that negative disciplinary actions affect African-American children starting as early as age 3. You heard me right, 3. The U.S. Department of Education just released a comprehensive study of public schools revealing in a report that black children face discrimination even in preschool, that preschool-aged children are suspended at all is hugely disturbing. Data from the 2000-year study show that black children make up only 18% of preschoolers, but 42% of them are suspended at least once, and 48% are suspended multiple times. Consistent with this educational data and taking into account broader demographic and family and economic data for children of various races, broken down by state, is a newer study released this week by the Annie E. Casey Foundation that found African-American children are on the lowest end of nearly every measurable index, including proficiency in math and reading, high school graduation, poverty, and parental education. The report, titled Race for Results, Pelini says, quote, the index scores for African-American children should be considered a national crisis. And two other studies published recently offer specific evidence of how black children are so disadvantaged at an early age. One research project published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology examined how college students and police officers estimated the ages of children who they were told had committed crimes. Both groups studied by UCLA professor Philip Goff and collaborators were more likely to overestimate the ages of black children compared with non-black ones, implying that black children are seen as significantly less innocent than others. And another study at the University of California, Riverside, found that teachers tended to be more likely to evaluate black children negatively than non-black ones who were engaged in pretend play. So although it's clear that negative behaviors are magnified through race-colored glasses, according to Yates, her study of children engaged in pretend play found that, quote, there is also potentially a systematic devaluing of positive attributes among black children. This made her concerned about how, very early on, some kids are being educated towards innovation and leadership and others are being educated towards more menial and or concrete social positions. So that's what we have. Now, my thoughts on this. There was a project in St. Louis, and it was a wonderful project. It was about 10,000 apartments. It had taken an area that was a low-income area and leveled it and built these public houses. And for a number of years, the tenants of this area saw a quality of life. But then the whites in the area of St. Louis began to move to the suburbs. They did not want to be involved in a mixed culture. And so you start to see these very affluent, smaller communities pop up surrounding St. Louis. And then when hard times came, the money that had been previously available to maintain these developments went in decline. As a result, things such as, well, water pipes bursting, especially in the wintertime, so a person had no water. Hence, there's no radiation in the radiators, heat. As a result, you were cold in the wintertime. Windows that would normally be repaired and replaced were not. Garbage that would be picked up wasn't. So vermin, rats were everywhere. And where there had been strict codes of conduct, now there were gangs. Now the vast majority of people living in the buildings historically had been just normal African Americans, but now these people were given no advantages at all. There was no support system. And in time, this became a magnet for crime and dysfunction, until it was finally abandoned and torn down. Here is the lesson. What do you think would happen if we took the fanciest building in Manhattan, one where the Koch brothers live and hedge fund owners live, and we didn't repair its windows, we didn't pick up its garbage, we left the heat off, they couldn't have running water for much of the time, all the doors were broken, there was no security, there were no doormen. How long do you think it would be before that building was abandoned by the wealthy and became a ghetto? You need support, no matter who you are or where you're at in society. Just imagine that you have a home on one of the 80 gated communities in Naples, Florida. Population year-round, about 250,000. Seasonally, about 325,000. Winter birds come in. Now, typically, a gated community will be 2,000 acres. You'll have probably upwards of 500 to 1,000 homes. There'll be several man-made lakes, golf courses, some tennis club. It's always manicured, beautiful weather, and for those people, they have a nice quality of life. After all, that's what they want. They worked hard, and they deserve it. Now let's say that we do the same thing that happens every day in cities around the United States. We no longer find that the people living there are important politically, and we no longer want to support them economically. So what do? Well, it's simple. We don't cut the grass. We don't clean out the lake, and hence it eutrophies, it overgrows. Algae spreads. We don't fix the fountains that are broken. We don't fix the water mains that are feeding the golf course. As a result, the golf course dies. We don't have security at the front gate. In fact, we don't have any gates, and we don't have any in any of the homes. As a result, crime becomes rampant because there's no deterrence. Quality of life deteriorates. And now people's homes no longer have air conditioning in the summer nor heat in the winter, and they're afraid to go outside. Now, that hasn't happened. Could it? Yes. Look at the 30 large malls that have closed down in the last 5 years around the United States. You would never imagine how they look now. There are photographs of them up on my website. I just put them up this week. These were at one time some of the nicest malls in the United States. No crime, places for kids to go and families and socialize and buy stuff, hang out. But now they're all closed up, and they've been overtaken by nature. It looks like something out of survival films, an apocalyptic film. So we have to realize that unless we're willing to support people and maintain a infrastructure, maintain some systems that will give them a quality of life, then anyone, anywhere in the United States could end up having massive poverty and squalor. And we never look at that child, the black child, that's 3 years old in school. We don't look at the environment they grew up in. We don't look at the quality of their diet. We don't look at whether they have a family or one parent. We don't look at the quality of the education of the parent, nor whether or not they're supported on any level with social psychologist or psychologist, behavioralist, or anyone else to help them deal with their own problems in life. We don't deal with what kind of neighborhood they live in, and is it safe for the child or the mother to walk the streets. We don't look to see whether or not they have an environment that's been maintained. Because if we did, then we would also have to say, why did we allow this neglect to occur? We would not tolerate that if it was our apartment or our home or our community. So I believe that we have not just engaged in racism, but we have engaged in a disconnect between each other in our society. And that's why we have so many people, mainly blacks and Latinos, who are considered, if they grow up in a poor environment, of being poor quality material for the future. And this is unfortunate, because we should not have this prejudice. Now, the Fort Hood shooter suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. That means he was on meds. And this is from Juan Cole from Common Dreams. Quote, the Fort Hood shooter left three victims dead and had been assessed for post-traumatic stress disorder. He had served for 4 months at the tail end of the Iraq War and suffered from anxiety and depression. 1 million veterans of the Iraq and Afghan wars have sought treatment for physical and mental medical conditions, either in the field or in Europe or back home at Veterans Administration hospitals. 35% of vets have been found in a Stanford study to suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And, quote, VA may eventually treat 1.5 million Iraq and Afghan war veterans as patients. Among these veterans, some sources reveal last year the post-traumatic stress disorder rate exceeds 30%. And one Stanford University study put post-traumatic stress disorder rate at 35%. If accurate, that means that 910,000 Iraq and Afghan war veterans may return home with post-traumatic stress disorder, which is often debilitating. The U.S. media almost never reports these numbers, giving the much smaller, though even sadder numbers of U.S. military killed, 7,000 in the two wars. The Iraq War was an elective war. It was fought for objectives that are still murky. It was illegal in the international law. George Bush and Richard Cheney took these brave men and women into battle despite the lack of serious threat to the United States from Iraq. The full harm they did these military personnel won't be known for decades. But all too often, observers concentrate on the soldiers killed in action, wounded physically, or suffering from physical conditions attributable to serving the war. The enormous psychological toll of these wars on soldiers, sailors, Marines is seldom recalled. Here are statistics, and here's what's important. The number of veterans who served in Iraq and Afghan, 2.3 million. The number of traumatic brain injuries, 437,000. Number of post-traumatic stress disorders, 800,000. Number of post-traumatic stress disorders likely to get minimally adequate treatment, 200,000. Number diagnosed with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury, 161,000. Number of Iraq and Afghanistan vets likely suffering from alcohol abuse, about 900,000. Percentage of the U.S. population that is veteran, 7. Percentage of suicides, 20% in America. So, what we have is we have a nation that sends men and women off to war for the wrong reasons, lies to the public, When these people are suffering, instead of being given the right treatment, they're given psychiatric drugs that they in themselves are harmful to the person and frequently lead to suicide. More American veterans are killing themselves than the total 7,000 that have been killed in the entire Afghan and Iraq conflicts. You think maybe someone ought to pay attention to the treatment, the medications? They should. They won't. And that's the end of our commentary today. I want to thank you all for taking your time, and keep in mind, we have dozens of outstanding articles published every day and put on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com's website to keep you informed, empowered, and active on important issues. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I wanted to make a quick announcement. Your audience may be aware that you are planning on reopening a new healing center coming up in Manhattan.
Yes, we are.
And I'm going to do a shout-out if people are interested. I am looking for people. It's going to be a rental situation. You would be renting offices. But I'm looking for a massage therapist. I'm looking for a great chiropractor, an acupuncturist. And even if you're a holistic medical doctor listening in, if you want to be considered, give me a call. I'm going to give you my home office. That number is 631-504-6198. Again, 631-504-6198. So give me a call, and I'll be happy to speak with you.
Luann, for a long time, there was the Tri-State Healing Center down on 72nd. About 4,000 people were treated there by some of the finest medical doctors. When the lease was finally up and I had other responsibilities, I decided not to renew the lease. And it's been a long time. And I've decided that now's the time to have another Tri-State Healing Center based upon principles of finding just a handful of the best healers, whether it's acupuncturists, holistic dentists, chiropractors, massage therapists, cardiologists, holistic psychiatrists, women's issues, health medical doctor on women's issues, internist, and homeopathists, Ayurvedic medicine. Bring these people into an environment so that, once again, people can have the best medicine at affordable prices, because I never did it as a profit. In fact, I lost a lot of money when I did it, but I chose to because I believed in compassion healing for so many people. And so the same principles be held again. So that's why I'm choosing at this time to do it. So it'll be open in the next 3 or 4 months. And we're just putting the word out now for people who already 3 physicians have been selected. And once it's all open, I'll announce it. People who are interested then can come to it. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
And let's, by the way, did you get any calls on the, because I'm busy doing our editing on our film on poverty every day, so I didn't have a chance to see if we're looking for someone who's got a green thumb, loves to plant, work with flowers, shrubs, and because on the homestead, we're going to have several botanists, agronomists, people working with planting all the time, every day.
Yeah, I've gotten a number of calls. Great.
Okay.
People.
Good. Okay. Have a nice day, everyone.